Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Why are we continuing to play this little game when we all know it has moved to the next stage?
Well, we've held off long enough, I guess, on asking the really cool question. That is, you know, what kind of spooky stuff have you experienced when you do these investigations? Because, you know, people always want to know about the spooky stuff. So let's talk about that. You know, what kind of weird stuff? You said it's mostly boredom and with fits of sheer terror, I think is
right.
What you said. Talk a little bit about those fits of terror.
The sheer terror.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if I would necessarily say that they were sheer terror as they were excitement.
Yeah.
I can't actually recall any investigation where, you know, where I've just been so scared that I've, you know, had to pull a dude run type thing. But, yeah, well, probably the one that sticks out of my mind the most is one that actually occurred several months ago, not very long at all. It was, let me kind of set it up for you. It was a tuberculosis sanatorium in northwest Arkansas. This particular facility is very, very large. It's a massive facility. From what we've been told, there was approximately 2,500 individuals that had passed away there. It was built in the, I want to say the 1930s, if I remember correctly. And back then, when you were diagnosed with tuberculosis, it was basically a death sentence. The experiments that they had, the treatments that they had, I should say, back then were basically very experimental. And as many people died from the treatments as they actually did from the disease as well. So they built these things called sanatoriums all throughout the country, generally in very rural, remote areas, with the understanding that these specific areas, these specific facilities, when you were sent to these things, you were basically going to die.
Yeah.
That's what the whole purpose of the facility was, is that you went there away from the general public to go die. So this particular location is very historic, lots of emotion, lots of energy tied to the place. It's a really cool place. I've investigated this particular location, gosh, I want to say 7 times. This would have been my 8th time.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, 7 previous times to this. This would have been the 8th time. And what occurred was probably, I don't even know if I can portray with words how incredibly awesome this particular investigation was, but I guess I could try. We were starting to wrap up for the evening. This was approximately 11:30, midnight. Mm-hmm. And this was a joint investigation we were doing with another group from Texas. It was a collaborative event. We were on the 2nd floor of the facility. The facility is basically, there's 5 floors. There is the basement, which houses a morgue, and then the other floors were patient floors, and then the 5th floor was another morgue. So this was on the 2nd floor. The 2nd floor actually had not been reported by many people to be reportedly haunted. So this was, you know, there wasn't anything special. We just happened to be on the 2nd floor. Tiffany, the vice president, was looking down the hallway. We were just kind of all sitting around talking, and there's about 25 people at this point. She was looking down the hallway using the FLIR thermal camera, and she said, "Look at that." And, you know, I looked over and didn't really see anything. And everyone's kind of gathering around, like, what are you seeing? What's going on? And I didn't see it at first. Nothing really started to happen to me. But she's like, didn't you see that? It looks like a little girl. And I was like, no, you're seeing things. It's starting to get late. You're tired. There's nothing that's happening. Well, no sooner had I said that than for lack of a better word, apparition appears on the thermal camera on the screen of what appears to be a 3 to 4 year old girl based on her height from the floor to the top of what I guess would be her head. Mm-hmm. She is basically the same temperature as the environment. She's not any colder. She's not any hotter. She's basically room temperature, but she has a very distinct form on the thermal camera. And I'm seeing this, and I'm thinking, you know, there's got to be some sort of explanation for this. Either it's, you know, there's some sort of weird airflow that's going on. There's something that is causing our brains to matrix this image and make us think that what we're seeing is not what it is.
Yeah.
So I decide, you know, I'm going to be Mr. Skeptic, and I decide I'm going to walk out to where she's seeing this thing and see if, you know, if anything happens. See if there is some sort of an air current that's present, or there's some sort of, you know, precipitate matter that's standing there, that, you know, me walking through it maybe will break it up on the thermal camera and you're not going to see it.
Yeah.
We all keep in touch with radios. This particular, what we were seeing was about 25 to 30 feet away. So I start walking toward it, and Tiffany says, stop, on the radio. So I stopped exactly where I was. You know, and I'm looking around. We're in a pitch black hallway, and, of course, I can't see anything, can't feel anything. You know, I'm just standing there kind of, you know, okay, come on, let's something happen. Standing there, nothing's happening. Of course, she's saying, it's right there, it's right next to you on the radio, and everyone's still watching this on the thermal camera. And, of course, I don't see anything, I don't feel anything. But she's saying, it's standing right next to you, it's looking at you. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. So I just thought, I'm going to stoop down. So I'm standing, and I kind of stoop down a little bit, and Tiffany radios, she said, it's right in front of you. She said, she's looking at you. I can see her standing right in front of you. So I stood back up, I walked forward, and as I walked forward, I got the most incredible chill that I've ever felt in my life. Every hair in my body stood on end. Next thing I know, Tiffany starts freaking out because whatever this was that I walked through basically completely obliterated my thermal signature on the thermal camera. And if you know anything about thermal cameras, when you image a person, you see lots of red. You see a tremendous amount of red indicating the heat from their body. Mm-hmm. Whatever this was that I walked through completely obliterated my signature. So where I had been completely red and you're seeing, you know, my body is being red, she said I was completely gone on the thermal camera. And we have this actually recorded. Completely gone. There was no thermal image for me whatsoever. So I kind of recovered from the incredible chill, continue walking, get back to the location where they all are, and we're all standing around just completely dumbfounded looking on the thermal imager while this little image, the apparition of a little girl is still standing there. Well, within about a minute after that, immediately to her right, another apparition appears on the thermal camera, and this is of a fully grown person based on the height off the floor. And what's interesting about this, it's the exact same as the girl, and that there is no thermal signature that's being produced. There's just a shape that you can see. It's not hotter nor colder than the ambient environment. But this thing is projecting a thermal signature on the floor, so you're actually seeing – you're seeing the shape of this person, and then you're seeing a reflected heat signature on the floor, but the heat signature is cold. It's a reflected cold signature. So whatever this thing was, it was projecting a colder temperature on the floor than a person normally would.
Yeah.
So anyway, so you can see that the man is very, 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 very clear, much more so than the girl. I never really could tell about the girl. Everybody else could see the girl except me. But the man is unbelievably clear. To me, he is, I mean, you could see a man very clearly. He folds his arms at one point. He walks away from the wall at one point. And it's just, it's absolutely incredible. It's an incredible piece of footage. That is probably, and, you know, thank goodness that we actually had the recorder going at the same time as that. But that to me is probably one of the most damning pieces of evidence that I've ever seen. If that had been caught by anybody else, any other group, if I had seen this exact same footage, I would have to call BS on it. I would never, ever in a million years believe that it was real. I would think that it had been manipulated because it is that clear, and it is that it's just that incredible. Both of the beings, I guess you would say, both displayed a certain amount of sentient ability, which is something that, you know, that's incredible too. You know, the girl was interacting with me based on what Tiffany was saying. She was looking at me. She looked up at me. And the man was folding his arms. He walked away from the wall. I mean, it wasn't just a simple, not just a simple reflection. There's not just, you know, a prosaic explanation for it. So that was probably the most incredible experience that I've ever had. Anything that I've ever seen is probably the most credible.
Wow, that's a cool story. That's sounds scary as hell. Now, what about, have you ever run into a situation where you felt any sort of like hostility from whatever might have been there, if you will? Have you ever seen, you know, been in that kind of situation?
Never.
No,
not personally. Never had anything where I just felt, you know, threatened by it and just felt like I had to get out. No.
That's good. What about poltergeist type situations? Have you investigated that kind of thing?
Yeah, we have. We've actually investigated several of those. It's the exact same MO as our other investigations. We really have not been able to, you know, capture the Holy Grail. I would say that the closest to capturing the Holy Grail would have been the full body apparition at the sanatorium, but
yeah.
You know, beyond that, no.
And that actually kind of segues well to the next point I have here in the notes, and that's you have a pretty strict policy on sharing of evidence
right.
at our past, and like I was going to say, this cool footage that you're talking about, that's not on the website anywhere where anyone can check it out, so it must be part of your evidence that you guys kind of hold back.
It's in the research database.
Oh, it is? Oh,
the research database we share with other legitimate organizations, but it's not publicly available for the simple fact that we're not a ghost hunting group. So we don't want to share our evidence for the most part and say, this is what, you know, this is a ghost. This is a paranormal event. This is a true paranormal event. Just because we're, you know, I kind of have mixed feelings about that. I think a lot of the groups that do that are really more interested in the sensationalism aspect of it. You know, they're really wanting to kind of do a little bit of self-promotion probably more than anything else. So they'll purposely publish their evidence for the public with the understanding, the full knowledge of that doing that is going to elevate them, I guess, in the public's eyes. And that's really not what we're doing. We are looking to share our evidence with research organizations, with other scientific groups. We're not really looking for the attention, I guess, is what it boils down to. So, yeah, we do have a very strict policy on evidence sharing. We do share evidence, but it has to be with another legitimate organization, not just, you know, any ghost group that starts up, you know, tomorrow we're going to share evidence with. Just, you know, a lot of the evidence that we capture also, most groups, unless they have the type of training, unless they have the type of equipment that we use, they're not going to understand the results of our stuff anyways. The equipment that we use, a lot of the data is analog data, a lot of it's digital data. They're not going to understand how to properly interpret the results of, you know, a specific piece of equipment unless they're actually familiar with it, and the vast majority of the public is not. So, you know, really, the public, the evidence to the public is video and audio and pictures, and that's it. And that is a very small percentage of what we do. So, you know, by not publishing that information, I think we're actually doing the public a service rather than putting a bunch of stuff out there and saying, you know, this is paranormal when we're not sure, or providing them with pieces of information that are open to interpretation, especially if they don't have the understanding or the training to interpret it.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it makes perfect sense. It makes perfect sense. And you've developed this SOCIUS database system. Talk a little bit about that, because it sounds pretty intricate, and it sounds like you have some pretty good goals as far as what that's all about.
Well, we actually have two database systems that we use. SOCIUS is our data evidence cross-correlation database.
Yeah.
That's where we enter in all of the data from the investigations. We're able to run correlative queries among the locations, look for patterns, look for things that are similar, look for things that are dissimilar. Yeah, that's a custom application that we developed and we use. The other database that we use is something called Paratracker. And Paratracker is our case management and member management system. So we actually a lot of what we do is very computerized. I mean, we've tried to organize and streamline the way we do things and keep things very organized. So databases are a very integral part of how we do that stuff.
Like, I understand why you're holding back the evidence and everything, but do you foresee any point where, you know, you guys may reach a tipping point or something where you may want to release, you know, your information in a way that'll be palatable to the general public, even if
yeah.
it's a website that sort of explains
sure.
how to interpret
well,
stuff.
Well, you know, we actually have done that. I mean, we've really relaxed. If you look, we've got a public EVP collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We actually have some EVPs that are actually out there for the public. So, yeah, we have a little bit relaxed on that. But like I had mentioned, you know, a vast majority of the evidence that we capture is simply in a form. It's in a format that people just don't understand. They won't understand how to properly interpret the results. And, you know, there's really no purpose in providing that to the general public. But, yeah, I definitely – I can foresee a time when that would change.
Yeah.
And especially with the with the exposure from the TV shows and, you know, as the public gets more awareness of paranormal investigation, especially legitimate paranormal investigation, there's probably going to become – there will be a time when, yeah, that probably will be something we'll do.
Yeah, and I can already see – based on just your EVP page, well, one of the reasons why it's probably good to hold back your evidence, because as soon as you post the EVPs, next thing you know, Randy and his Kentucky ghost hunting group is going to say they made the EVP and put it
on
their website.
Yeah, we had to put a staunch notice on our website about that because we found somebody that was using some of ours.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's unfortunate. There is so much drama that occurs in the paranormal community that, yeah.
Well, that's a good segue point, because that's kind of the next thing I want to talk about is this big sociological trend of the ghost hunting fad. And it's a fad. Let's not mince
words.
Thank
absolutely.
You.
It's a fad. It's you know, that it's the strangest thing. I write a monthly column for another group called Paranormal Awareness Society, and my column for this month was actually on drama. So, the paranormal community is the smallest group of backbiters, I think, that I've ever run across. I have no explanation for it. I mean, you know, some of these groups, that seems like that is their mission and their focus in life is to cause problems for other people or other groups. And I don't understand that. You know, if all of us are supposedly in this for the same reasons, you would think that there should be a certain amount of unity that's present, and there's really not. You know, the amount of drama, the amount of backstabbing, the amount of crap that occurs in the paranormal community, it's incredible, absolutely incredible. I've you know, some of these people are just very immature. They're in this for the wrong reasons. I don't know. Yeah, it's huge, absolutely huge.
What can be done about this oversaturation of ghost hunting? Are you just going to have to wait for it to burn out, and the people that jumped on the bandwagon will be the first to jump off once the next big thing comes up?
Yeah, that's exactly. You know, that really speaks well to, again, the whole issue of us releasing evidence. You know, we release evidence to other legitimate groups and we ignore the other ones. And, you know, if that's what it takes to bring more legitimacy to the field by weeding out some of the charlatans out there, that's what needs to happen. You know, if it's just denying access to some of these fringe groups for investigation locations, if it's, you know, denying them access to legitimate scientific data, then, you know, that's what needs to happen. Whatever we need to do to weed out some of these self-aggrandizing you know, the people that are in this for the wrong reason, they just need to move on.
yeah. It's the same in the UFO field. It's the same in all the other fields. It seems like it's just the bane of the existence for the ghost hunting field because it's so popular right now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, eventually maybe the people will all weed themselves out. But, you know, we've taken the stance that we're just not going to deal with those people. So we deny them access to our data. We deny them access to our research findings. We just basically, you know, push them aside and let somebody else deal with them. Eventually, maybe they'll get the clue and just, you know, decide that basket weaving is a more interesting hobby.
There you go. Now, at the risk again of telling tales out of school, my main problem, I guess you could say, with ghost hunting groups is just the amateur nature of it,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the fact that you know, to paraphrase Brad Steiger, who was on my show, you know, they watch ghost hunters,
yep.
And, you know, they think they can become ghost hunters,
yep.
And they don't do any of the background research. They don't know anything about the history of the field.
Or have any training.
Exactly, or have any training, or, as you point out on the website, they have a serious lack of professionalism.
Exactly.
I guess I want to know, like, what, being kind of a gossip, I guess you could say, what's the drama, though? I'm more down on them just because I feel like, you know, They're jumping in with both feet before they do the legwork and pay their dues, if you will. Mm-hmm. I hate to use that expression, but I do for this.
Well, you know, really my problem with them, other than that they taint the community with bad data, is that, you know, that they make it more difficult for legitimate organizations like my group to investigate some of the locations that we want to. You know, there has been locations that we've contacted that prior to us contacting them, they've had another group that has come out there and investigated, and they've had such a bad experience with that group. It's left such a bad taste in their mouth that they think all paranormal investigators are like that.
Yeah.
They think that every group you know, is a bunch of unprofessional yahoos running around at night, you know, in the dark with their camcorders running. And, you know, that's in stark contrast to how we actually perform our investigations. But, you know, at the same time, just because those people did it, we're all kind of in the same community, so we're labeled in the same regard that they are. It's probably the same with, you know, the Bigfoot community, the UFO community.
Yeah.
You know, one person screws up and it makes everybody look bad. So, you know, my whole beef with those people is that, you know, they're giving the legitimate people, the ones that are actually going about things the proper way, they're giving us all a bad name. Of course, once these locations and once people actually see, you know, hey, we're totally different, we actually do things in a completely different manner than they do, you know, then kind of the tone changes. But it shouldn't even have to get to that point. We shouldn't even have to explain, or we shouldn't have to, you know, show what the differences between those groups and us really are. I mean, we shouldn't even have to be put in that situation in the first place, but unfortunately that's the way it is.
It's disappointing. You know, it seems like nowadays the path to becoming a ghost hunter group is, you know, first you decide you're going to become a ghost hunter, then you come up with a cool name.
Yep.
Then you make your t-shirts.
And get your website. And, yeah, exactly.
and then you become a ghost hunter. I mean, just here in the New England area, which is, you know, has its gothic sort of background with all of its background, you know, there's so many ghost groups, so many paranormal groups that it's just completely oversaturated.
Yep.
And
it makes it more difficult for legitimate groups to actually get in and do things.
Exactly. It's a big problem, and it's one that obviously the people in the ghost community know about, but the people outside the community, you know, in the other fields are probably just like, wow, ghost hunting is really popular now, but
right.
I don't think they realize the long-term damage that might be done right now to the field of ghost investigation as a result of this fad nature of the field.
Well, you know, there is a lot of telltale signatures of a legitimate group that really could be used, you know, to determine the legitimate from the illegitimate. But you're exactly right. You know, on first contact, people are going to say, oh, another ghost hunter group. They're not going to actually take the time to look in and see what the differences are and see that there actually is a strong difference in methodology. But yeah, it's a bad deal all around. Hopefully, you know, I've been doing this for way longer than it's been cool, and, you know, hopefully it's going to go back to the way it was, and people will lose interest or move on to something else and, you know, let us get on with our work.
And what was your reaction, I guess, to this explosion? Like, kind of like someone who is a fan of, like, a local band, and then they become big, and then you're like, they're not like they were back in the day, back when they were playing the bar scene when I saw them. It's kind of like that sort of thing. You're like,
well,
oh,
you know,
shit.
It's really funny. When I first started to see a lot of the paranormal shows coming out on TV, my first thought was, you know, this is really awesome. This is going to bring a lot of awareness of our hobby or interest to mainstream public. And I thought, you know, this could only be a positive thing. And I think it really was at first. It definitely was a positive thing in that it opened up people's eyes to the fact that there are groups of dedicated people that go out on their own time doing the types of things that we do. And, you know, that really opened a lot of doors for places to be investigated. But then you started to see more and more groups start. You'd have a group start, you know, in one town, and then two groups, and then three groups, and then pretty soon you'd have 10 groups. And there really was such a fast explosion of the paranormal community that I got very disheartened by the whole thing. You know, there was several times during my tenure of doing this that I've, you know, wanted to just throw the towel in and just say, you know, this is just too frustrating. There's too many other groups that are out there trying to do what they're trying to do, and it's, you know, it's too hard for me to get in locations because I'm having to try to compete with these other people. Even though, you know, we're worlds different than those people, again, in the public's eyes, we're the same,
yeah,
at least at first glance. So, yeah, at first I thought it was very positive. Now it's, you know, to me it's kind of shifted, and it's more of a negative. It's more of a liability on the legitimate researchers.
And do you see the trend waning or getting worse? Because it seems to...
Oh, it's getting worse. I mean, you know, to me it seems like, you know, now there's more shows on TV, and now there's more people that are starting to do this. You know, it seems like it goes in, it kind of ebbs and flows.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with our membership. You know, around Halloween time, things start to spike a little bit. And it seems like it's kind of the same thing. A new show comes out, and there's new ghost groups that start. And, you know, a show goes off the air, some of the groups go out of business. And, you know, it's kind of there's peaks and valleys, kind of ebbs and flows, but no, if anything, I see it getting even more, at least in the short term, it's becoming more and more of a problem.
Yeah, yeah. Just based on my own observation, I would presume that it's got another couple years before it really starts to burn out. Just from watching,
so.
I like to compare it also to the 9/11 movement, because you kind of saw that explode like about 2 or 3 years ago, and I would say 2007 really was a really down year, I think, for the 9/11 movement, and it kind of correlates with sort of the explosion of the ghost thing. So maybe the people that were down with the 9/11 thing, now they're into the ghost hunting, and in a couple of years, you know, they'll be doing UFOs or some other aspect of the esoteric.
Well, if it trends down like that, then I guarantee you we'll still be doing this, and hopefully it'll be making it easier for us.
The ghost research field needs contraction right now, not expansion,
right.
And that seems to be part of the problem is the expansion. You know, there's just so many groups. It's insane. And like,
it is.
I accidentally found out there was like a group in my town, and I'm from like a small town, and there's like two people in the group, and it's like, listen, you're not a group. If you're two people and you're investigating one haunted place in my town, like, sorry, but you're not. It's just the way it is, you know?
Well, you know, and the Internet's really, you know, that it's done wonders for people. You know, anybody and their brother can start a little group, start a website, and all of a sudden they're a group. I mean, and someone over in England can find out about, you know, Tom and Joe's paranormal group in, you know, BFE Kentucky.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Now, what do you – now, you said there's ways to tell the difference between a legitimate group and you know, an amateur hour fiasco. So why don't you, like, kind of share that sort of thing for us so people who may be interested in contacting one of these groups will know the difference so they don't get mixed up with one of the wrong ones.
Well, I think the easiest way – and this is probably going to upset a lot of people – but I think the easiest and most efficacious way to determine it is look at their website. I mean, if you look at some of these groups' website, you know, they've got dripping blood, they've got black backgrounds, they've got skulls. You know, they've got stuff that is not professional. They've got things that, you know, you wouldn't typically associate with a research organization or a scientific background. I think, you know, at first glance, the website, that would be the first thing to check out. If they have a legitimate-looking website, it's professional, you know, they actually know how to use a spell checker, you know, that's probably one of the first things. Second thing is look at the member base. If you've got a member base that consists of two people, like you had mentioned, that's not a group. That's just two friends getting together. If you look at their equipment, thirdly, of course, all of my comments here are specifically tendered toward a scientific bent, mm-hmm. You know, groups that are attempting to research this from a scientific perspective. But if you look at their equipment, the types of equipment that they have, the breadth of equipment that they have, the types of things that they do with the equipment, you know, that's another pretty good indicator. If you look at a website and it's, you know, it's got a black background, it's got the dripping skulls, you know, and their equipment consists of a camcorder, an EMF meter, and a thermometer, you know, that's probably, you know, that you really have to wonder, does that group really have the proper equipment to scientifically look at all of the possibilities? Probably not. The next thing to look at is, do they have a personal liability waiver? Do they have any type of an insurance bond? Are they liability bonded? You know, we have $1 million policy for ourselves and our investigators, so when we go to a location, you know, the homeowner can be assured that we're not going to tear the place up. We're insured, so there's no problem with that. Are they actually an organization? Have they actually been chartered by their state? Do they actually file incorporation papers? Have they filed nonprofit? Oh, I shouldn't have skipped this. One of the probably the number one way to tell the legitimate from non-legitimate is that a non-legitimate organization will charge for investigations. Not all the time, but you do see that, and I'm seeing that. That's an alarmingly increasing trend, and that's something that's very troublesome for the legitimate researchers, is that people will charge to do their investigations. I can't tell you the number of people that have contacted us asking how much we charge for investigations. We don't charge a penny. If anything, we should be paying you for allowing us to conduct our research in your, you know, in your home or in your facility.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of these groups will, you know, they'll say that we'll get rid of whatever it is that's bothering you for $50 or $100, or we'll charge $100 to do an investigation. That's wrong. That is completely off base. So if there's a group that charges for that, you know, run. That's another one that would be illegitimate.
That's stunning. I'm stunned just to hear this.
Oh, tremendous amount. There is a tremendous amount of groups that actually charge for it. You know, and they'll come up with lots of different excuses for, you know, justifications for the charging, you know, for gas, for, you know, their time.
Yeah.
For the equipment. I mean, it all boils down to they're trying to make money at it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not a field that you can make money at. I mean, really, this is not something that science, for the most part, is not a spectacularly lucrative field in the first place. But especially this. I mean, this is you're preying on people's emotions, you're preying on people's fears, and you're trying to capitalize on that, and that's just completely wrong.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those are some pretty good signs. There are, you know, with that being said, you know, I think we've both painted this huge doom and gloom picture. But, you know, with that being said, there are legitimate groups that are out there. Mm-hmm. You know, besides our past, there are other legitimate groups that we associate with that are just as fastidious. They're just as detailed as us. They are in it for the right reasons. They, you know. But for every, you know, one legitimate group, there's probably 10 illegitimate groups.
Yeah, yeah, it's unfortunate. And what about the TAPS people? Are they now, I know you're part of the TAPS family.
We are part of the TAPS family.
Which sounds kind of creepy. Don't drink the Kool-Aid, please. what now, do they oversee that sort of thing? Are they fastidious about, you know?
Very much. Believe it or not, what you see on TV is not the way the TAPS organization actually is. The TV show is billed as an entertainment show, and it really is. I mean, all of us are big fans of the show. It's entertainment. You know, it's a great show to watch. You know, it's not billed as a scientific documentary. It never is. That wouldn't sell advertising. It's a quasi reality sci-fi show. And, you know, that's fine. It has its purpose. It's fun. It's great to watch. We're all big fans of it. But with that being said, being part of the TAPS family is great. The TAPS family is a group of basically independent, research organizations like RPAS throughout the country that have basically all come together under one big umbrella to share resources. And what's really been helpful about the TAPS family is that if we have a question about something and we don't know the answer to it, none of our consultants know the answer to it, you know, generally we can post asking for feedback on the TAPS family board, which is it's a restricted message board that we all have access to that we can share ideas, investigative ideas, membership issues, that kind of stuff, and kind of, mm-hmm. you know, have a large forum that we can bounce ideas off of. The other thing that's really interesting is that it really opens up all of the TAPS family members to investigations well outside of their state, which is really nice. We've been invited to do investigations with other TAPS family members all throughout the U.S. Sometimes we'll get investigation requests from outside of the state, but there'll be another group, another TAPS family that's located closer, so we'll be able to recommend them. They're very – to get into the TAPS family, it's pretty difficult. You actually have to go through a lot of steps to actually be a member, and they try to keep it controlled for exactly the reasons that we've talked about.
Yeah.
They don't want a bunch of yahoos in that group. They try to keep everybody basically in the same they try to keep it so it's the same methodologies, that we all have the same goals. So it's actually a very positive thing.
Okay, yeah. The jury's still out for me on the TAPS crew. I'm not sure what their deal is, really.
Yeah, the show is completely different than the actual TAPS family.
Yeah.
The show is entertainment, and it's not indicative of what being a member of the TAPS family is.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll be the first to admit, I'm insanely jealous of their success. So,
sure.
I mean, and I'm man enough to admit that. I'm not, you know, I'm not gonna crap on them because they're wildly popular. You know, if anything, I'm just green with envy at how popular they are. But then I wonder, you know, because they are so hugely popular, you know, the trickle-down effect, which is what we've been talking about here for like the last half hour, it's a double-edged sword, you know? They have to incur the blame in some ways for what we've seen the ghost hunting field become, just because
absolutely.
They are
there's no denying that. But, you know, in the same vein, they've also turned back around and created the TAPS family.
Exactly.
To you know, put legitimate researchers out there as well.
Yeah,
and
so
make sure
that
we're all on the same. Yeah.
One of the really cool trends that I've seen in the ghost hunting field, and I was looking at your website and your membership and the people that are in your various research groups, and that's young people in ghost hunting. It seems like, you know, as we said, it's a fad. We kind of have established that. And, of course, where there's a fad, there's young people.
Right.
And that's really cool, though, in a way, because, you know, if we can draw in 20 young people, when the fad's over, we may still have five that stick around, and that's five more than we would have had otherwise.
Right, absolutely.
I guess just talk about that trend of young people embracing ghost hunting because, you know, as we pointed out here on the show, you know, the UFO field is a serious lack of young people. And we were, I'm jealous of the ghost hunting field getting so many young people, but I am intrigued tremendously by that trend. So I guess just talk about young people and how they seem to gravitate towards ghost hunting.
Well, I think it comes back down to the TV shows. You know, that's the culture of today is, you know, unfortunately TV bound. So a lot of these, more youthful individuals will see the TV shows and they'll think, you know, hey, I'd like to get involved in something like that. Actually, if you look at our membership roster, it's about 50-50, young people and old people. Well, old people. I guess that's kind of a subjective term. But it's about 50-50. I don't know exactly what the split would be, but I'd say, you know, the young people I would consider up into 25, 30, and then the other people would be, you know, 30 up.
Nice. So I'm still young.
Yeah. So, you know, it's kind of even for us. But yeah, it's nice having the young people knowing, you know, that these people really are dedicated to this and that there really will be somebody to pass the torch to, as it will.
Yeah, because we need more of that in all branches of the paranormal field, ufology, cryptozoology, conspiracy, ghost hunting. We need more young people. If ghost hunters, you know, takes off, and it, obviously it has, and if it draws more young people in, eventually they'll start sampling some of the other fields and they'll get into
those. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And plus they bring a lot of new ideas.
Exactly.
You know, the technology that kids are taught nowadays and the things that they learn are vastly different than, you know, what I learned 20 years ago. So, you know, it's nice. They really bring kind of a breath of fresh air to things.
Sort of a big picture question to sort of wrap up the sociological aspect of the discussion. Where do you see the ghost hunting field in like 5 or 10 years, you know, after this trend's kind of burned out? Will it recover? Obviously, I presume it will. I mean, we still have ufology and it's gone through serious ebbs and flows in popularity and it's still around. So I presume ghost hunting will too. You know, where do you see it in the future? And do you think how it will handle, when its popularity starts to falter?
Well, you know, I really think that the people that are truly dedicated are going to stick to it. You know, the people that really have an interest in it and the people that really have a commitment to it are the ones that are going to stay in it. You know, in 5 to 10 years, that's really hard to say. There is so much research that's being done now, and, you know, science is just barely starting to, you know, understand a lot of the things about our natural world now. So, you know, maybe in 5 to 10 years, there'll be more of an understanding of the unnatural world. I don't know. That's a really good question. You know, I really hope that, you know, mainstream science takes the paranormal phenomena a little more seriously than they have. You know, maybe dedicate some research to it that has not been there in the past. So I don't know. I really don't know where we're going to be in 5 to 10 years.
Do you think that there'll be more of an embracement towards your style, toward our past style of research with more of a scientific bent and a reliance on good technology, because it seems like as technology advances, you know, it gets a little cheaper, more people can get it, and maybe that'll be hopefully a trend that'll grow.
I think so, but at the same time, as I mentioned way earlier in the show, there's always going to be a need for the other types of groups as well. You know, the spiritual aspect of things, the groups that you know, are really more about the metaphysical aspects of this. There's always going to be a need for that. There's always going to be a want. Basic human need, I think, is something that, you know, it doesn't change. So there will be probably more of a focus, I would think, on the scientific aspect of it, but at the same time, it's not going to solely be the one focus, I don't think.
Yeah. You say you've been doing this for 12 years, you've done a ton of investigations, and even though only a very small percentage are what you would deem as unnatural, unexplainable, based on all your years of research and your work with other people in the field and other people in various other fields, what's your big picture thoughts, I guess you could say, on what ghosts might be. What do you think they are? Do you have a sort of pet theory or a hypothesis maybe about what is really going on?
I do. It's pretty long and drawn out. Basically, though, what I think is happening with paranormal phenomena or ghosts is that there is basically a parallel reality. There's a parallel dimension. This other dimension, I think we are able to, at times, bridge the gap. You know, Marie and I are currently writing a book called Parascience. It's going to be exploring the links between consciousness, resonance, and the zero-point grid. Mm-hmm. And basically what we're going to be focusing on, one entire chapter is going to be on paranormal phenomena and how paranormal phenomena is linked together inexplicably, I can't even talk, with everything. So, you know, what do I think? I think that everything is linked. I think everything that we see in our reality may not be the only reality that's there. You know, there may very well be another two people just like you and me having this exact same conversation in another parallel dimension that we're not able to access. We're not able to tune, kind of like a radio receiver. You know, we can't tune it to the station. Maybe the vibratory rate is too low. Maybe the vibratory rate is too high, but we cannot view that particular radio reception. There was a theory that I had read, oh, it's been several months ago, and it was recently rehashed in a book by Graham Hancock called Supernatural, where his book, he's basically talking about that the brain is a receiver of consciousness rather than a creator of consciousness. And if you think about that for a minute, that's pretty deep. Mm-hmm. And I tend to agree with that. What I think is happening is that a lot of the human experience that we have is simply being received. It's not something that's being created. So where I'm going with that is ghosts or paranormal phenomena, I think, they're no more dead. They're no more different than you and me. They're just different, but yet we're all linked. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, they're existing in another area that we should have access to, or maybe someday will, but right now don't.
And there are certain times where that veil is somehow broken to the point where we actually can have contact. You know, like the experience that I had at the sanatorium. You know,
yeah.
I don't know what it was. That's what we're hoping to discover via environmental conditions. But that's really what I think is happening.
And you said that you hadn't noticed any trends in those key cases, so you wouldn't really be able to say that there's any sort of like environmental thing that.
No, not at this point. That is our entire the premise of our group. That is what we want to do. We want to be able to determine what it is, and then eventually say, well, here's the conditions that are necessary for the event. Now let's try to recreate it.
Exactly. Yeah, that sounds exactly like what you'd want to do. Is there anything you think that could be sort of like the Holy Grail or the ultimate evidence, if you will, to prove ghosts to the people that are non-believers, if you will? And that's kind of a lousy question. I phrase it probably poorly, but I think you get the point I'm trying to say.
I do get the point, and I don't think so. I think there is always going to be the diehard skeptics that no matter what evidence that you present to them, there's always going to be some fault that's found with it. I think you could present the most solid case ever, and it you're still not going to get any traction from the non-believers. I mean, if look at how the world was believed to be flat. You know, there was all this evidence that had been presented. You know, the world's not flat, the world's round, but yet still the scientists of the day, until they actually had better understanding, you know, you were labeled a heretic by saying that the world was round. So, no, I don't think so. I think that there's always going to be skeptics. There's always going to be people that no matter what evidence is presented to them, no matter how overwhelming the information that's given to them, you know, whether it's personal agendas, personal beliefs, they're still going to, you know, just kind of believe what they want to believe.
Yeah.
It's probably the same way in the UFO field. You know, I follow the UFO stuff pretty carefully too. That's something I'm personally interested in. So yeah, I think it's the same in your field as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Have you done any UFO investigations, or are you primarily in the ghost realm?
Primarily the ghost realm. We've got a, I guess you would say, a cryptozoology investigation that is upcoming. But no, we primarily stay in ghosts. But I would love to do something with the UFO. But, you know, the difference being that UFO events are generally after the fact. You're usually investigating something that has already occurred.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not really any way to predict when a UFO event is going to occur. It's generally after the fact. Versus paranormal, it's a little bit different. So, you know, I don't envy you for your job. I think you actually probably have it a lot worse because you're just investigating evidence that's left behind versus I'm trying to investigate evidence that's currently occurring.
Yeah, well, I'm just an interviewer. So. Now, we talk a lot about on here the need for sort of a little more sort of cooperation between the big genres, if you will. You know,
sure.
The Bigfoot people don't want anything to do with the UFO people. The UFO people, they don't want anything to do with the ghost people.
Sure.
All that kind of stuff. Have you noticed that sort of problem in the ghost realm? Because I'm really unfamiliar with the ghost hunting field aside from what I've observed, really. I haven't really
talked to anyone. Oh, yeah, definitely.
In the field.
You know, as I was mentioning before, the drama that's in the paranormal community, there are groups that absolutely will not work with any other group. They absolutely will not. I heard a story, this didn't involve us, but I heard a story from a friend of mine in another group. She was telling me that they went up to, I won't even say where, but they went to a city outside of their city in a different state to do an investigation. They were invited by the property owner of this location. They went into this other city. This other group contacted them and said, "You can't come investigate anything in our city without our permission."
Oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, like, you can't come investigate anything in our city unless you ask our permission. So, they a lot of those groups just will not work with anybody else. I've noticed that, too. Those kind of speak to what we were talking about the groups that really hopefully will weed themselves out and the groups that are really not interested in the scientific or the legitimate aspects of the field. They're really just in it for different purposes.
Yeah, attention probably.
Attention mostly. I mean,
yeah.
Generally the groups that do that are the ones that are trying to get their name out there. They're trying to get themselves more known.
Yeah, for God knows why. We don't want these people.
they want a TV show. You know, they want some sort of fame and fortune. They see, you know, like you had mentioned, the Ghost Hunter show. You know, they see the tremendous success that they've been able to attain, and they think that, you know, that they can do the same thing, I guess. I don't know.
I feel bad for them because the paranormal field is no place to make a living.
Absolutely not. This would not pay the bills at all.
Yeah, I can attest to that personally. I guess just to sort of wrap it all up, what's coming up next for RPAS? What do you have on the horizon for the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies team? What do you have coming up?
Well, we've got a large investigation this coming weekend at a cave in northwest Arkansas that we're investigating. It is a return visit for us, and I'm really looking forward to that. We got some excellent Class A EVPs at the last one we went to. Let's see, what else do we have upcoming? We just did a submarine. We did that one.
Oh, wow.
We did a museum. What do we have? What else do we have? I'm trying to think of what's on the calendar. We try to split things 50-50 between private residences and historical locations. We've got a battlefield that's coming up, and we have a Indian mound that's coming up, a state park that we're going to be investigating.
Nice, nice. What about any speaking engagements for you? Or I know you say you're working on a book here with Marie. What's going on with that?
I'm working on a book with Marie. We're in the initial stages of actually writing it. We've put together the proposal and everything else. Beyond the book, we have a conference that we're working on that we're hoping to get done, or hoping to have done by September. We'll actually put on a nationwide conference. What else? We are filming a documentary that we're going to shop around to some of the shows. It's going to be primarily on the scientific method in paranormal investigation. That's about it. That's all
nice.
I can really think of. That's the major projects. Parrot Tracker, the application that I talked about before, our case management and member management system, we're putting the finishing touches on that. We're going to be offering that to other paranormal groups that want to organize themselves and become better organized entities.
Nice.
That's it,
nice.
Really.
Sounds good. Well, Larry, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show and for being really generous with your time. I apologize for going way over the hour, but the conversation was so intriguing that I really just couldn't stop here. But I really want to thank you for coming on the show, for giving me so much of your time. Like I said, I was initially skeptical at first, but you made a believer out of me in the sense of what our past is all about. I'm happy to see there's groups like yours out there. I want to see more groups like yours. I want to see less groups like local neighborhood ghost companies going on. Less of those, more our pasts. That's what we need. You're doing a service to the field of ghost hunting, Larry. I appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to seeing some of the results from your research and seeing some of this stuff come out to the surface as time goes on. Best of luck on all of your great investigations.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
That does it for this week's edition of BOA Audio Season 3. Big, big thanks to Larry Flaxman for coming on the show. Of course, you can find out more on Larry Flaxman and the Arkansas Paranormal and Anomalous Studies team at www.arpast.org, arpast.org. Check it out. Following up on some stuff from last week, I have just about secured the okay from all of the great members of the BOA staff for appearances on our little spin-off program, BOA Audio After Hours. They were pretty tough negotiators, I'll be honest. I have to send Leslie a bowl of all yellow M&Ms. I'm not sure why, but that's what it takes to get her on the program. But we're going to get it done, and we hope to have BOA Audio After Hours ready for you soon, I think, actually. No news yet on BOA DC, but I've got a couple other things percolating. It's been crazy around here, folks. Just been crazy. But there's a lot of things in the pipeline, and we'll keep you posted at this part of the program next week. And now it's time for the segment that many of you know and love as BOA Audio Listener Feedback. Here we go. The email comes from Matt Richardson, who hails from the UK. Here's what he has to say. Dear Tim, just to say how much I enjoy your interviews, I'm based in the UK, and listen to the MP3s. Brilliant stuff. The interviews with Peter Robbins, Nick Redfern, and Nick Pope were outstanding. Regards, Matt Richardson. There you go. Short and sweet. Thank you very much for writing in, Matt. I love my UK listeners. They are awesome. They hold a special place in my heart. I lived in the UK for a little while. It was an awesome place. Can't wait to go back there and see London again. Ironically enough, unbeknownst to Matt here, who wrote in about Peter Robbins, I have been in touch with Peter Robbins recently. We've been kind of talking back and forth. So don't be surprised to see Peter Robbins make his triumphant return to BOA Audio sometime in the not-too-distant future. If you would like to be a part of BOA Audio Listener Feedback, there's two ways to do it. Either write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. Either one of those methods puts your correspondence in the ever-growing list of letters for BOA Audio Listener Feedback. All right, what else? Of course, the thanks. Big, huge, super huge thanks to the awesome crew at BOA. Leslie, Chiron, R. Lee, Joe V., Tina Senna, and Rochelle Hawks. Week in, week out, top-notch reading material. Rochelle Hawks has an outstanding piece we just posted yesterday about UFO-themed episodes in classic sitcoms from the Cold War era. You want to read this one. It will knock your socks off. It is outstanding. Leslie and Chiron have been on top of this UFO Hunters story over the last couple of weeks. Tremendous material from both of them, looking at the UFO Hunters versus UFO Hunters story from a number of different angles. They are definitely holding down the fort here as far as keeping track of the UFO news in the esoteric media. I can't say it enough, my friends. If you're only listening to BOA Audio and you're not reading the columns at banalofamerica.com, you're only getting half the story. Definitely check out the columns and see why so many are making BOA a part of their everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. On the subject of donations, I want to give a big shout-out and thanks to the donors who have been giving us donations over the last couple of weeks. I was thrilled to check the account and was really surprised by the number of donations and the potency of the donations. Big, big thanks to those folks. You know who you are. If you want to be a part of that crew that is helping support BOA and BOA Audio and making sure the website and the audio series are available to all of our great listeners the world over, go to banalofamerica.com. Click the PayPal button, and make a donation. No donation is too small, and all donations go towards offsetting the costs of the BOA franchise. Now, here, as we close out the show, there's only one thing left to talk about, and that's next week's program. It is an ultra-ambitious episode of BOA Audio. We're going to make the call to nearly 8,000 miles away, Cape Town, South Africa, for the first ever American interview by Christo Lowe, head of South Africa's UFO resource. This really is an amazing conversation. Christo shares a ton of fascinating UFO stories that have happened in South Africa over the last century or so, including some just amazing cases, like the 1989 UFO shootdown over Botswana, the Bainbridge incident, crazy stories about UFOs picking up cars, UFOs moving giant rocks. It's just tremendous stuff. We're going to find out about famous South African contactees like Elizabeth Klarer and Carl van Vlerden. We're also going to find out all about the history of UFO studies in South Africa and how it compares to its American counterpart, the big picture influences on the field down there, like the government, the military, and the media. How are they shaping the UFO culture in South Africa? We're going to find out from Christo Lowe. If you're interested in the UFO phenomenon and you're interested in the global aspect of this story, then this interview is a can't-miss edition of BOA Audio. It's tremendously educational. I learned so much from Christo about what was going on as far as the UFO scene in South Africa. As I said, his first ever interview on an American broadcast, and it's going to be on BOA Audio next week. We're traveling down to Cape Town, my friends. Strap yourself in. It's going to be a wild ride. On that exciting note, we're going to close it out here this week on BOA Audio. Thanks so much for listening, folks. This is Tim Banal, signing off.